We all have some kind of a secret desire to break the law. Some kind. And I don't mean break the law in the, you might say, the traditionally accepted sense, like make a big protest or whatever. I'm talking about sneaking around doing something terrible. Somehow. And I don't know whether to tell this story or not tonight, because this is the story. I think I will tell it. I think I just will go all right out. That when we think in terms of outlawry, of the dishonest, not even the dishonest, but let us say the beyond the pale, we generally think in terms of pretty conventional kinds of outlawry. Stealing, adultery, things like rustling, breaking into a bank, violence. But I'll tell you, no, really, we think in terms of conventional kinds of outlawry. But, Daddy, there are lots of kinds. One of the most exotic outlaw examples that I have ever known was a thing that one time I ran into when I was a kid. And I will tell you this on the air. Now, you'll have to follow this. And this is an amateur radio story. This is one of the few cases I've ever heard of the true outlaw breaking out in the amateur radio ranks. Now, for those of you who don't know anything about amateur radio, I'll have to explain this and preface it with the fact that the amateur radio hobby is really a combination of science, hobby, technological skill, and it's highly controlled and licensed by the federal governments all over the world. In other words, every amateur radio operator has a federal license that is granted to him after a long and arduous study. It's not an easy thing to get a ham ticket. And, of course, you probably heard of a Citizens Band Radio and so on. That's not the same thing. Amateur radio is like a little radio station just with a call letter, a call sign, just like WOR here. You know, I'm amazed at how many people do not realize that radio stations are federally licensed. I was talking to a grown guy this week, literally, a grown man who's been living in this country all of his life, and he suddenly said, you know, I'd love to have a radio station. I'd like to get some money together and build a radio. I said, well, you know, you've got to get a license. He said, what? I said, well, you've got to get a license. He said, well, what do you mean a license? All you got to do is get the equipment, build it up, and they'll give you a license then. He did not recognize the fact that the WOR has a license and is licensed to operate on 710 kilocycles in this area, and nobody else is allowed to have that license as long as the owners of the license operate and maintain it within the FCC regulations. In short, it is a licensed thing. If you decided tomorrow morning, for example, to start a bus line on Fifth Avenue, just tomorrow morning, why don't I go out and get a couple of Volkswagen buses, you know? There's a lot of people that miss buses. I'll just go up and down Fifth Avenue and start picking them up. I'll make regular stops. You know? Oh, boy. You'd last about 10 minutes, and they would have you down on the pokey so fast it would make your head spin. Well, the amateur radio bands are very highly licensed. Everybody who is a ham has a call letter. He has a regular station call letter, just like WOR has its own call sign, and they're not selected by the licensee. They're issued by the Federal Communications Commission. Every ham has one. Now, you got the scene? And getting one is a very complex thing. You study, you work. First of all, you have to be dedicated. Very few guys get a ham license just casually. You know, just, I think I'll get one tomorrow. You just don't do that. It's almost like getting a pilot's license or something like that. And finally, when you've gotten this thing, it is a tremendous achievement. Then you achieve a certain identity, and you are allowed to go on the various amateur bands with your equipment and operate. Of course, at that point, you're highly skilled already. You know it. You have the whole thing down pat. You've got a license. Now, you got the scene? Well, I'm a kid, you see, and I begin to study amateur radio. I was fascinated by radio technique, and there was another kid in the neighborhood who built radios, and I got involved. Well, one thing led to the next, and I'm reading Shortwave Craft, Hugo Gernsback, you know, and I run across a couple of copies of QST, which is the amateur radio trade journal, and it slowly began to suck me in. And by the time I was 13 years old, and by the way, this is rather unusual, in those days particularly, very few kids were hams. And I got sucked into it by the time I was 13. By the time I was 14, I was involved up to my ears, and I'm studying. And amateur radio operators, licensed hams, began to have an almost godlike status to me. And they were all had individual personalities, distinctive personalities. And I'd listen to them on my receiver, and I'd hear these different guys, you see. Oh, I'd say, wow, there's W9PLW. Whoo, boy, I'd be a fan of his, you know, I'd listen to him. There's W9JZ, I'd be a fan of his. And I knew all their rigs and everything. I'm a listener, you see, and studying and struggling. And they began to have really a tremendous status in my mind. Well, finally, the day came when I was ready to go up and take my amateur radio license test. And that was a big day. That was probably one of the biggest days in my whole history. And I went up to the old post office building in Chicago after a year of intensive studying on the code and the whole scene and flunking about 9 courses in high school and everything. And I finally get up there, and I take the test, and I go home and wait. Well, I've told this story before of getting the license. Well, I got my license, and now I was W9QWN. And it's just like... You know, it must be the same way that a young doctor feels when he gets his license to practice medicine, and he still is a little scared. He still figures he doesn't know anything about it, actually, you know. And he stands next to old Dr. Gillespie and feels, you know, sweat breaking out. And yet he's licensed and he's able to. Well, that's the way I felt with these hams. I went on the air, and here are the big hams all around, you know, the big guys. And this little peanut signal comes on the band, and it's me. Well, I took to going to clubs, you know, they have clubs, and I would sit in the back there, and all these big-time guys would get up. You know, this is like a little second baseman with some Class D ball team sitting back and watching Bobby Richardson or watching somebody like Roger Maris. I'd sit back there, and they'd get up, and they'd talk about 20 meters, and they'd talk about... Speaking of amateur radio, this is WOR AM and FM, New York. Well, it got really, so you got a little of the picture. The hams really had a tremendous status to me. And they were licensed, remember, and extremely legal. The FCC patrolled the amateur bands like a silent, invisible squad car. And it's highly policed. So if an amateur is working outside the band or doing something illegal, overnight, practically, he's tagged. Somebody, a listening post all over the world, you know, hears him, boom, he's in trouble. He gets a couple of these tickets, and the next thing you know, he's really in trouble, and his license is taken away. It's very, very tightly controlled. Obviously, it has to be, because the guys are operating all over the world, you know. Your signals are heard everywhere. You're interfering with other services, and it's really a complex thing. So one day, I'm on the band, you see, and I'm talking to this guy. Now, get this now. You got to hear this. I'm talking to this amateur. And he is just a ham, you know. He's a guy I'm talking to, and he's a young guy, see. And he's a very, very knowing ham. He has all the nomenclature, and he's got all the language, and he's got a fine rig, and he's giving me a kind of advice. He's talking to me. And remember, I'm a licensed ham, see. And he's giving me, well, look, son, you do so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so. And so we got talking to each other on a very close basis. And for maybe 6 or 7 months, we were very closely involved. And I'm talking to this guy back and forth and got to be close friends, only on the air. Now, you follow this? And all the other hams are talking to him, too. He was one of the gang. Well, one day I decided that I was going to come over and see him. I was going to drop by. Well, I dropped by, and here he is. He's got a beautiful setup. He's got all the equipment, and he's got maps all over the wall, and he's got QSL cards all over the place. And I'm sitting there, and I'm very impressed. He's a real big-time ham. And we're sitting around, and he has a beer. And then and I'm a kid, of course. I don't know. He has a beer, and then he has another beer, and then he has another beer. And by the time he has his third beer, he's sort of chuckling around and laughing, and we're talking. And then it came out, he did not have a license. He was a bootlegger, a phony ham. This is a guy that was on the air, he was signing a call sign, and he was a phony ham. And I was dumbfounded, you know, because there is an amateur radio call book, you see, that is it's like a directory of all amateurs everywhere, every place. And this guy had somehow taken somebody else's identity. A guy that he knew back in his hometown someplace who had died, and he had taken this guy's call sign and was using his name and was living in Chicago and was a bootleg ham. I was astounded. I couldn't believe it. And yet, at the same time, I was vaguely intrigued by this. Here I was, a licensed guy. Well, we got talking about this thing, and it came out, and he swore me to secrecy. And the next night, he took me to a meeting of this highly respected amateur radio club in Chicago. It was a small but respected club. It was well known. And I'm sitting down in the club room, and here he is. He's one of the big wheels in this club. And there's about 25 other guys sitting around, and they're all talking, and they've got a club station, and they've got tickets on the, they've got the QSL cards on the wall, and they're drinking beer and talking. They have a speaker there from one of the big technical organizations telling about modulation and all that, Ed. And they have refreshments and all that. And towards the end of the meeting, this guy says to me, "Of course you realize this is a bootlegger club. Not one of these guys was licensed, and they had all the trappings of all the regular people. I couldn't figure out why they didn't get their licenses," you say. And there they were. It was an entire crowd of bootleggers. Well, I don't know how I got in. After that, it was a very funny feeling. I would be on the band, and I'd hear all these guys talking, all the regular licensed guys, and in the middle of it all is this bootleg crowd, all talking back and forth, and all totally illegal and not licensed, and bootlegging all the way. Well, now you follow. Now you're following me up to this point. Now here's where the most exotic outlaw, I'd say, adventure I've ever heard in my life took place, and one of the most interesting kinds of juvenile delinquency I've ever encountered. I went back a couple of days later to the next meeting of this club. I was just fascinated by this, and I had mentioned it to a friend of mine. I said, this is insane. And he says, no, that's ridiculous. What are you talking about? He'd worked all these guys, and he said, couldn't believe it. I said, yeah, they're all bootleggers. Oh, wow, there's not one of them. He said, what do you mean? That guy's been on for 10 years. I've heard that guy for years. Why, if you're working the X. And here they're all bootleggers, every last one. So I went down to this meeting, and here is a kid about my age. And he is one of the bootleggers. He's got a call sign that he's taken, and each one of them had stolen a sign from somewhere, call letters, so that they had covered their tracks beautifully. It was really like counterfeiting. It was a fascinating thing, because it's not easy to do this, especially in the open, and so well organized as these guys were. They had all taken call signs. They had phony identities. They would talk about how they had moved from Mattoon, Illinois. Of course, that's where the guy was listed in the call book. And they had the identity. It had even gone so far as to learn a few people in that town and streets, so if they were asked about it. And it was quite a complex thing, and they all operated absolutely strictly according to the law. These guys were super legal hams. They were all very correct. They made the correct calls. They were absolutely beautiful operators. They had to be, you see, because the minute they ever got a ticket, then they're really in trouble. So it's like a guy driving without a driver's license. He's got to drive 50 times better than a guy with a license, you know. He's got something going for him. See? So these guys were really good hams, and they had the entire town, as far as I know, they're still doing it. They had the whole Midwest taken in. They were just artificial hams. Well, about 3 days after I met this kid, this young kid who was the guy in the youngest guy in this crew, he was the only one I had anything in common with because he was about my age. I met him on the street one day, and he said, "Why don't you come over and take a look at my rig?" Well, I went over to this guy's house, and his rig was incredible. This kid had built all of his stuff in a closet, and he had it designed so that nobody could see it from the outside. It was all built in there. He was a true bootlegger, so that if anybody came in at any moment, he would slam the closet door and throw his tennis shoes in there and hang his overcoat on, and that's the end of it, you know? He's all covered up. And so he's down there, talking away, and I'm standing, and he thought I was a bootlegger, you see, because I had been at this club meeting. Here I was, a licensed ham. I was a fink, you know? I was secret fuzz. So I've got this ticket, and I'm licensed, and I'm feeling rotten. It's fascinating to find out how you, in your own world, will develop a sense of guilt because you're legal. You know, in an illegal world, I know that more than one guy is driven into some insane things because of the fact that everything around him is insane. He literally will go that way because he thinks that's the way it should be. Well, I'm feeling guilty when I go to these meetings because I've got the license in my pocket. See, and all these other guys are phonies. Somehow they were more legitimate than me. I was the fact that, you know. Well, we got talking. I got to know this guy. I will call him for the purposes of discussion, Don. So I assumed, of course, that the reason that all these guys were bootlegging is because they could not get their licenses. That's a very long, hard, arduous task, and a lot of them just fail and finally wind up by bootlegging, just the way I suspect that a lot of phony doctors wind up being phony doctors because they can't go through the course, you know? They get hung up somewhere about the third year, and they wind up somehow phonying up a degree and working way out in the woods someplace as a phony doctor. Well, that's what I was assuming. Well, I'm hanging around with this kid. I'm feeling real funny, you know. Gee, I better get out of here because if I, you know, I'm going to get caught in this dragnet. That's going to be terrible because they're going to clamp down. One day, I'm on the band. It was a wild scene. I'm on the band, and I hear this amateur station talking to this kid. You know, saying, let's just take any call. Let's say W9-6SJ7, W9-6, this is W9-QWN here. And I want to run some tests with you. Would you come on, give me some tests? I want to run some receiving tests here. I want to polarize my antenna. Hello, 1, 2, 3, 4 now. Will you come back and hold it for about 10 minutes? Just make about a 10-minute transmission because I'm experimenting with polarizing my receiving antenna here. I'm going to switch from one antenna to the other to see whether or not I can do anything with a ground plane antenna. I've got a receiver. So he's going back. I'm listening to this, you see. And so the kid comes on and he starts to talk. And he's talking away. He says, well, 1, 2, 3, 4, are you still picking me up on the Charlie? Hello, yeah, well, I'm after. All of a sudden I hear, boom, they are raiding him. It is the FCC, and they have zeroed in on this guy, and they slam the door open, and they catch him sitting there in front of his closet with the earphones on his head and the microphone in his hand and a pair of red-hot T-20s in the final. There he is. They have been pursuing this guy for about a year, apparently, and they finally threw the hooker into him. Well, I hear this. I'm listening to the band. Uh-oh. Well, that night, I'm listening on the band, and it is wild how quiet traffic was that night. The word, of course, immediately got out among all the bootleggers, and they were laying low. And only the official hams were on. And it was funny because the other guys didn't know anything about it. I was the only ham on the band who knew what had happened. They do not publicize these things. And so I'm listening around, and the guys are saying, gee, I can't understand. Where's Roy tonight? Hey, if you're listening, Roy, I'm here talking to Johnny. And if you're listening, Roy, well, give me a shout, will you, after this cue? And so dead silence. W9-6SJ7, you're on the band tonight? And I hear little comments like, gee, I can't understand. There's hardly any QRM on the band. Band is awful dead tonight. Band is dead. Well, of course, I knew what had happened. There were about 5,000 guys in the city of Chicago hiding in the coal bin. And you know, they're down there behind the coal waiting for the banging on the window. Well, of course, it came out. This kid had been hooked. And they got him, and they brought him up before juvenile court. Now, here is where the delinquency starts that becomes really exotic. They brought him up before the juvenile court, and they said, now, look, you're a bright kid. You've studied all this stuff. You've got all this going for you. Now, cut it out. And they gave him a warning, and they said, don't do this anymore. No more. Absolutely no more. A warning. Because he was only about 15 or 16, about 16, I think, at the time. So he laid off. That was the end of him. And about 4 days later, not 4 days after he was nailed, boom, they catch him on 10 meters. He has taken another call, and they grab him. Obviously, the RI's car is hiding out in the woods somewhere with the DF antenna on this guy's house. And he fired up on 10 meters, and they threw the net over him, and they drag him kicking and struggling off to, again, this time, federal court. And he is standing up there before the bar of justice, and the judge says, all right, you know the law, and I'm not going to, you're a minor, I can't throw the book at you, But I am going to make it so that you cannot operate for a good long while, and I'm going to make sure that you get something out of it. And with that, he told them he either was going to go to the CCCs, did you ever hear that? The Civilian Conservation Corps, or else he was going to find himself in some kind of a reform school. So this kid, you know, and I knew him, said he's okay. And the gent says, and one thing, he says, they've got a radio set up there in the CCC camps, and I want you to study and get a license. Well, the kid goes off to Wyoming. And with that, he starts to study, and sure enough, 5 months later, he's got himself a license. Now, get that. This is where it starts really getting exotic. He gets himself that very difficult amateur radio license, and now I am working him back and forth, and all the guys are working him. You know, everybody feels great. You know, old Don got a ticket now. And so he's out there in Wyoming. We're working back and forth, and he's up in the woods there, and they're chopping down the trees. And about 8 or 9 months later, he shows up back in Chi. Shows up in Chicago. He's bronzed. He's about a foot and a half taller. He's 6 inches wider, and he's licensed. He's got a real official license, which he shows me. I can even remember his call, which I will not give you, since it will incriminate. He says, here, and he really did have it. He honestly got himself a license, and he had been working the CCC station there and was their official radio operator. Now he was really official. Well, so everyone was delighted. And he comes back, and he joins the official radio clubs and all that, and he goes back to school, and he's rehabilitated, and this time he's official, and he's got a ticket. And he starts to go on the air. Well, about maybe 4 or 5 months later, he disappears from the air. I don't hear him anymore. Well, that happens, you know. I figure, well, maybe he's rebuilding. Maybe he's moved to another neighborhood. Who knows what? But he disappears. And silence for a while. Now, you got that? Silence. Let us show the passage of time for, say, 5 months. And he gradually slipped out of the minds of everybody. When one day, boom, out of the darkness, the FCC throws the net over him again. What do you think he's doing? He is broadcasting out of a closet of his house using somebody else's call. He can't stop bootlegging. He's a licensed ham, and it had no kick for him, apparently, when he got his ticket. So now he is hiding in the closet, still with his real license in his pocket, broadcasting with a phony call sign, and he is on the air, and they threw the net on him. This time now, of course, he's about 19 years old. He's no longer a kid. And they drag him kicking and screaming away from his double-button microphone, his earphones dragging behind him, his T-20s popping in the closet, and they throw him in the wagon, and off he goes to the federal courthouse. And this time the judge says, what is your call sign? And he says, W96, this is the official call. He says, let's see your license. And he looks at it. He says, we have checked in the official records, and you are officially licensed. You are really licensed. Why were you signing W9ABCDEFG? Long silence, and he's standing there. He says, we have been tracking you for 1 year. For a year, you've been signing every different caller in the book. What is this? Long silence. He says, well, this time you've had it. 1 year and a day. Federal pen. Take him away. Take him away. As far as I know, in a cell somewhere now in Leavenworth is a guy with the greatest DX list of all hams in the Western Hemisphere. He has a list of call signs behind his name, 2.5 feet long, and he is in that cell and probably building himself a 20-meter single sideband transceiver to hide in his tennis shoe to keep contact with those DLs that are coming in from Western Germany. Now, that's a true story. I did not invent that story. Now, there's one for the psychologist to deal with. Now, and it can be explained psychologically. You know, there's an explanation for it. But what was so intriguing is the fact that most of us think in terms of outlawry. We really do think in terms of the more common things, the lust things, stealing, greed, adultery, one thing or another. But this is a guy with an almost, obviously, well, almost, it was totally an uncontrollable desire to be illegal. But to be illegal in a highly legal society and in a legal way, which gives it more, more, because he was operating absolutely legally. He did not do anything illegal when he was on. He didn't swear. He didn't do any of these things. He was an exemplary operator when he was on, but he could not use his own legal call sign. Oh, boy. Now, that is the kind of outlawry that could only exist in a highly technical society, obviously. And yet, I'm sure that Jesse James would have understood this guy. You know? The two of them could say, yeah, you know, because there is a common bond, you know, a common bond. One of the craziest criminal things that I've ever heard of in my life, I don't know whether I've ever told you this on the air, because it was such a strange story. Not only a strange story, but it has odd connotations in our time, and furthermore, it's difficult to tell a story about a thing which people may not know enough about to understand the nuances of, you know, this is a thing. Well, I'll tell you this, that in radio stations, generally speaking, radio and television stations, there are always people who sort of hang around. You know, there are guys who have a burning desire to be in radio and television. And understandably, it's an interesting business. I love it, you know. And most of the guys who are in it, even though they complain bitterly, would not be in any other business. That's literally true. right, Eddie? Right. I could see you in the tie department at Macy's head, you know. But literally, it is a fascinating business. There's no question about it. It has all kinds of ins and outs. There's the creative side, and there's the angry side, and there's a lot of things about it. But it draws people just about in some ways the way Hollywood draws people. People hang around, and they look, and they want to be in it, and there is a great mystery about it on how to get in, you know? It's a great mystery to most people on how do you get to be in television, how do you get to be in radio? And so most people just give up. They don't even fool around, you know? They go to work at the car body plant, and that's the end of it. It's some mysterious thing, and that's the end. But other guys make the scene. They try to do it. Now, they hate you hanging around, and the guys in radio and television, of course, get used to that kind of thing. And I'm not talking about fans. I'm talking about people who have a burning desire to be in. Well, I was working in a radio station and TV station out in the Midwest, Cincinnati, as a matter of fact. And at the time, I was going to college and so on, and I was usually around the station at night. And it so happened that a couple of young guys got to hanging around. And they were about my age, and they'd hang around, and they were fascinated by this. And they'd look goggle-eyed in the control room, and they got to know the engineers, and they would run out and get sandwiches for them and so on. And they got to be sort of part of a scene. You just kind of accepted them there. And you'd see them, and you'd say hello to them, and that was about it. And once in a while, there'd be a little discussion on how to get in radio. But it was obvious that these guys absolutely were dedicated. They were going to get into radio. They were going to get into radio and television, and they were really involved. Well, about 6 or 7 months went by like this. And one day, they stopped coming in. And one thing led to the next. We were all wondering about it. And then nobody thought any more about it, and that was the end of it. And months went by. But strange things started to happen in radio stations in that area. Very strange things. A small radio station in an Ohio town about 30 or 40 miles north of Cincinnati had a transmitter way out in a cornfield someplace. And it was what they call a daytime station. You know, the station goes on the air when dawn comes up, and it goes off the air when the darkness hits. Well, one day, the boys came to work about 7:30 in the morning to turn the station on the air, and the transmitter was gone. Somebody had stolen the transmitter during the night. Well, this is the kind of horse thievery this is a kind of rustling that I'll tell you, you know, it makes you stop and think. There's not many things you can do with a 1,000-watt AM transmitter. There really aren't. You know, you can't play records through it. You can't use it as a refrigerator or a hat rack. There's the only thing you can do is put it on 12:30 on the dial and hope for some commercials to come in. Well, it was gone, the transmitter. And of course, there's a little excitement, a little ripple in town, you know, all around the radio station. I was crying out loud. You hear about what happened to W. Whoopi over there, you know? Well, it's good enough for a rotten programming. So, well, they were off the air about 3 or 4 weeks while their new transmitter arrived. Well, then that died down for a while. Of course, a little excitement. Naturally, the detectors were put on it, but they couldn't discover anything. And a few months later, suddenly, the masked writer struck again. Another radio station, this time in another town just outside of Cincinnati, again a daytime station. They came in to work one day, and their Raytheon console and 2 turntables and 4 microphones had disappeared. Boom! Cleaned out, just like that. Well, now let me tell you, a Raytheon console for a 1,000-watt station is a pretty big piece of equipment. It's about 6 feet, wouldn't you say, Ed, about like that? Probably weighs a half a ton with its associated desk equipment and 2 big RCA turntables and 4 or 5 great big Western Electric mics with the booms. The whole jazz disappeared, just like that. Well, of course, by now, people began to piece these things together. They said, for crying out loud, what do you think of this? This is an insane story, you know. Wow, you know. And automatically, there were a lot of little shyster surplus dealers that were beginning to get strange visits from guys with black suits, you know, and snap-brim hats who had bulges under their elbows, you know, and had the unmistakable look of fuzz about them. And they're down, you got any microphones? Yeah, turntable. Well, nothing. They turn up nothing. And then, finally, the real blast hit. A radio station right in town, right in the middle of Cincinnati, was one of these stations that was on till midnight, something like that, and they would sign off, and they would go on the air at 5 o'clock in the morning. Most radio stations sign off around 1 o'clock in the morning, something like that. And this station was right smack in the heart of town. And she signed off one morning about 1 a.m., ready to go on again at 5, and there was a maintenance man there, and he fooled around a little bit, and apparently, you know, he would take a nap, and he would do a little work, and then he would go down and have coffee. Well, this maintenance man went down and had his coffee, and about 4 o'clock in the morning, he came back up, and he dusted things up a little bit, you know, and he's walking around, and kind of, you know, just getting things underway, and walking around back and forth. When the crew started to come in, and the engineer who was on duty, a bellow of rage out of the control room, somebody had stolen the audio bay. A 6-foot audio bay. Boom! Just like that. Oh! You know, this is fantastic thievery. You can't believe it. Well, this, of course, by now, the whole town is agog. You know, all the radio community is wild. This is an insane kind of rustling. You never heard of anything like it. And then people began to call up and compare notes. And they found that things like cabling had disappeared. Different radio stations were talking. Yeah, one radio station had like 795 records taken one night, you know, LPs and stuff like that, back and forth and stuff like that. And they began to realize that a sneaky, clandestine radio station was being assembled somewhere. It really was being assembled. Well, in the middle of the afternoon, on a quiet fall day without any warning, a loud hum came on the low end of the band and went off. And there was a silence. And, of course, immediately the FCC starts to move in. And about 6 hours later, they closed in on a Quonset hut. A little Quonset hut that had been used as a silo on the outskirts of Cincinnati, and the squad cars pulled up with all the DF equipment, you know, and they saw those darkened windows with burlap tacked over them, and they could hear sounds in there, you know, like hammering and stuff and talking. And they slowly crept up and whipped out their 45s. All right, you guys, up! And there were our 2 young radio men surrounded with $45,000 worth of radio equipment and they were all prepared to go on the air with their own radio station. They even had signs that said, on the air, you know. They had log books that they had stolen. They had the mics all set up, and they had packed beaver board all around. They had built themselves a little studio. They had their control booms there and their mics. They even had, you know, the shades that the jazzy gist jockeys wear, a couple of guys with grown beards. And they had a girlfriend of theirs sitting out in the front to take calls from the commercials. They caught the whole kit and caboodle of them. And they had run a wire out to the telephone pole and back, number 12 wire, and somehow they tuned up this 1,000-watt transmitter and got it vaguely on the air. And there they were sitting, and no one knew quite what to do. And they began to cry. One guy's 19. He said, I want to get in the radio. I don't know how to get in. They say, you got to have experience. How do you get in? And the other guy, who's 20, says, yeah, you guys, you always say you got to get in. You got to get experience. Where are you going to get it, for crying out loud?